Good afternoon. My name is Robert Lamb. I am a senior fellow at the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS. Welcome. Today's event is being recorded. It will be available on CSIS.org and at iTunes University. So please be kind and set your cell phones, iPhones, and Blackberries to buzz. I'd like to welcome our guests from the British and Norwegian embassies today, Deputy Chief of Mission Dominic Chilcutt of the United Kingdom and Deputy Chief of Mission Johan Vibe of Norway. I'd also like to thank the Embassy of Norway for their ongoing financial support. Today in Istanbul, Afghan President Hamid Karzai and Pakistan President Asif Ali Zardari are meeting in what some people are calling a fence-mending session, which I think is promising. Tomorrow, they'll be joined by most of Afghanistan's bordering countries for a regional summit to talk about regional cooperation. Last week, the U.S. Department of State released their Afghanistan and Pakistan regional stabilization strategy, prepared by Special Representative Holbrooke's staff. And in 3 days, most of the countries and international organizations involved in the Afghanistan conflict and the reconstruction effort will be meeting in London to discuss the road ahead in Afghanistan. And the road ahead is rocky. Our own Anthony Cordesman has been analyzing the trends in this conflict for some time. And by just about every measure, and despite the best efforts of the Afghan people and the Afghan government, tens of thousands of U.S. and European and other international troops and civilians, this is a war that we are not winning. The insurgent attacks, the number of attacks have been on the rise for the past few years, as have combat casualties and civilian casualties. The number of provinces in which the Taliban and other insurgent factions have set up shadow governments is now up to 33 out of the 34 provinces in Afghanistan. That's up from 11 in 2005 and 28 provinces in 2007. Poverty is endemic, and the people are among the least literate in the world. Many places lack even basic infrastructure. There's some reason for hope. Most Afghans, by all accounts, do not welcome the prospect of a return to Taliban rule. A lot of villages have formed community self-defense militias specifically to defend against insurgent attacks. And in fact, a lot of low-level and mid-level Taliban and other insurgents aren't even really true believers in the insurgency. They're fighting either for a salary or for strictly local reasons. There have been recently some tantalizing hints that possibly some top-level commanders of the Taliban might be willing to negotiate. And on Thursday, the international community is coming together to perhaps commit more resources, more troops, more civilians, and we should hope perhaps more coherence to the overall effort. Dominic Chilcutt has been in the diplomatic service for more than 27 years. He served in Iraq, Sri Lanka, and obviously in this conflict zone we call Washington, D.C. Britain is hosting the London conference, obviously, and Dominic will give us a preview of some of the issues that will be discussed there. Johan Vibe has been in the Foreign Service for 2 decades. He's served in Latin America, including in Haiti, also Sri Lanka and Pakistan, and has also done peace and reconciliation work in Norway itself. He'll talk about some of the challenges and opportunities for the reintegration and reconciliation program, and I wouldn't be surprised if he says some words about problems with international civilian coordination as well. They'll speak for about 15 minutes each, and then we'll open it up for question and answers.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. Good afternoon, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here at CSIS. I'm going to talk about the London Conference on Afghanistan, and I'm going to do it under the following headings. I'll say something about the overall message of the conference, something about the context in which this conference is taking place. I'm going to go through the kind of nuts and bolts of the conference with you, because I think that is interesting in itself and tells us about the conference as well. Then I'm going to talk a bit about the political strategy, which we think is an important aspect of the overall effort in Afghanistan, which the conference is going to give extra momentum for, and then dwell a little bit on the three themes of the conference's work: security, governance and development, and the regional framework. So that's what I propose to talk about, and I hope that I will keep more or less to time. But equally, I hope that if I don't, you will be patient and kind. So first of all, then the overall message about this conference. I mean, the starting point must be, of course, that a more stable and secure Afghanistan is vital to the national security of the United Kingdom, the United States, and many other countries in the wider world. And we cannot afford to allow Afghanistan again to be run by the Taliban regime that gave safe haven to Al-Qaeda, which, of course, allowed them to launch the attacks on the rest of the world, including, of course, on the September 11th, 2001, which was an attack very much against the whole of the West, even though it took place in New York. To prevent this, the government of Afghanistan has to be able to sustain its own security, be able to exercise sovereignty over all the country and its territory, offering its people representative government, bringing about the conditions for economic prosperity, and be a country which plays a constructive role in its region. Now, we have a military campaign which, despite what Bob says, I think is maybe more on track than he gives credit for. Anyway, it's certainly unfolding as we speak, and I was talking to a British Member of Parliament who was back from Afghanistan. He visited only last week, and he said you would be amazed. He's been to Helmand province a number of times, at the degree of progress that is being made there. But maybe that's something that will come up in our discussion. But the overarching goal of this international coalition effort, of course, is to create an Afghanistan able to sustain its own security against the insurgents and the terrorists. Already more than 90% of ISAF operations are now conducted with the Afghan National Army, which is already about 100,000 strong. The target for the end of the year, as you know, is 134,000. And there's been a huge surge in international military contributions. And General Stanley McChrystal, the ISAF commander, is implementing a counterinsurgency strategy, which, combined with a clear political strategy, of which more later, we believe provides the clear roadmap for success. And it's that combination of military and political which is the key here, because we believe that we cannot win by military means alone. We do need that complementary political strategy. And we want the London Conference, and this is the essence of it, to produce international support for this combination of military and political strategies. We believe that these two elements, an increasingly effective military campaign and a clear-sighted political strategy, are the key to restoring momentum to the Afghan government and the international community's efforts, and should prove to be the winning combination. When he announced the London Conference on November the 28th, the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown said that its aim was, and I quote his words, to match the increase in military forces with an increased political momentum, to focus the international community on a clear set of priorities across the 43-nation coalition, and to marshal the maximum international effort to help the Afghan government deliver. So there again, in the Prime Minister's words, you have this sense of military effort combined with political strategy and political effort. What is the context for this conference? Well, it doesn't stand alone, this conference. It's part of a series of meetings. For those of you who wish, you can see the origins of the concept going back to the London Conference in 2005, or indeed to the Paris Conference of a couple of years ago. But more recently, there have been meetings of the special representatives for Afghanistan and Pakistan and the group of embassies that come together in Kabul, the Joint Coordination Monitoring Board. And both of these meetings took place in Abu Dhabi and Kabul this month. And as Bob mentioned, there are important meetings in Turkey this week, the Turkey-Pakistan-Afghanistan meeting today, and the meeting of a wider regional group tomorrow. So there's a kind of continuum of international effort on Afghanistan. But nonetheless, London, in a way, the London conference this week, is a kind of jewel in the crown of this stream of effort because of its timing and because of the numbers of delegations that are coming to attend it. Its aim of garnering international support for the Afghan government's efforts, I think, is well understood. And just to continue this idea of a sort of a stream of effort, we expect London, the London conference, to be followed by a conference in Kabul later in the spring, and who knows what after that. Why now? Well, I think the timing of the London conference is particularly well suited to developments both within Afghanistan and more widely. Obviously, President Karzai has re-elected and has been newly re-inaugurated. He set out his program in his inauguration speech, and we have a new Afghan government taking office at the moment, well, not completely yet in position, but very much on the way to being in office. Outside Afghanistan, of course, we've had the President Obama and the administration's review of policy. We've had that draw to a conclusion, the uplift of troop numbers, and the reaffirmation of the counter-insurgency strategy led by General McChrystal. So these two things mean that the moment is now opportune in the light of these important developments, and not just to take stock, but to take stock and set out a path for the future, a path that will, we hope, take advantage of these new developments to inject new momentum into the Afghan government's and the international community's efforts. I'll say something about the nuts and bolts of the conference as well. We know that London is the venue, but we are not the only hosts. The conference is a joint effort between the British government, the Afghan government, and the United Nations. And as such, it has three co-hosts, President Karzai, the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, and the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. I mentioned a moment ago the number of delegations. At the last count, I think we reckoned we had 77 coming. Of course, all 43 ISAF countries will be there, as will, I think, all the regional countries, with the possible exception of Uzbekistan, who have declined attendance. Most of the Gulf countries are coming, and others too. And, of course, we have a number of relevant and important international organizations as well. The day of the conference itself, Thursday the 28th of January, the structure of the day, it's really in five parts, although it has three themes. So I will do my best to make sense of this slight Rubik's Cube effect. The three themes I mentioned, security is the first, governments and development the second, and the regional framework, or international architecture, some people say, is the third. If I go through the conference agenda very, very quickly, the first thing that happens after people arrive is that the three co-hosts will come into the conference venue and make opening remarks. So it'll be kicked off by President Karzai, by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and by the British Prime Minister. That they then make way for the chairs of the conference, who are David Miliband, the British Foreign Secretary, Mr. Rangin Spanta, who's the Afghan Special Representative, and Kai Ida, who needs no introduction to us, of course. And they will kick off then with the first session on security, where the NATO Secretary General and the Afghan Defence Minister will be the keynote speakers. There will then be a second session before lunch, because you see they'll be rattling through this pretty fast. The second section on governance and development, where the Afghan Finance Minister, the Director General of Subnational Governance in the Afghan government, the Managing Director of the World Bank, and a senior IMF official dealing with the Middle East and Central Asia will be the main speakers, setting the scene for that discussion of governance and development. Then in the afternoon, there are two more sessions. The first session, straight after lunch, is a session with civil society representatives. It's a short session. There's a group called their initials, I think, are BAAG, although I think it may stand for the British Association of Afghan NGOs, who are having a sort of civil society Afghanistan summit earlier in the week in London, and they want to come to the conference on Thursday to present their findings to the conference, which they will do immediately after lunch. And I think there's going to be a particular emphasis on women's and girls' rights in Afghanistan and what they have to say to the conference, though obviously as they are civil society, non-governmental organisations, I can't presume to speak for them. Then they'll be followed by the third subject. Oh, it's actually, I mean, confusingly, it's called session number three, but I count that up as the fifth session, in fact. But it's the third subject. You're still with me? You're doing very well if you are. The third subject, this is called the regional framework, and this is where the Afghan foreign minister and the Turkish foreign minister, His Excellency Ahmet Davutoğlu, will speak. And, of course, the Turkish foreign minister's role is particularly relevant given these meetings that are happening today and tomorrow on this subject of contributions by the regional countries to the stability and peace in Afghanistan. Right, and then there will be some conclusions or a communique, and the communique is going to set out at least two sets of commitments that the Afghan government will undertake over the next period of 18 to 24 months, which is, of course, the crucial period that we're talking about. And secondly, commitments by the international community responding to the Afghan government's programme. There may also be, as one of the deliverables or the outcomes of this conference, either announcements or confirmations of one or two senior civilian appointments. We may have more news of those in the next few days, but obviously I can't say anything in detail about those until those people are decided and announced. Afghan leadership of the subject matter is going to be a key component of this conference. You'll notice there are Afghan speakers in all the main sessions, and those Afghan speakers are kicking off each of those sessions. This is not an accident. The agenda is very much being set by the Afghan government and then followed by the international community in its comments on how it wishes to support the programme that is being set out by the Afghan government. And our ambassador in Kabul, Mark Sedwell, made this point in an interview, with the BBC. In the last few days, he was emphasising the London conference would be the first meeting of its type where the agenda would be set by the Afghan government and followed by the international community. And he said, quote, "There have been a whole series of international conferences on Afghanistan, and most of them have largely been about the international community deciding what we are going to do in Afghanistan," he said. "This one is designed to be, and I believe will be, a turning point in that it is the first time when the government of Afghanistan themselves are really setting the agenda and the international community are responding to it." That's a significant difference there. Yes, indeed, it is. Now, I promised I'd come on to the political strategy, which I've referred to as one of these two main components, which we think are the key to achieving success in Afghanistan. The British government believes that military and civilian resources need to be marshalled behind this clear political strategy. And political because it involves shifting the motivations, the relationships and behaviours of critical stakeholders and power brokers. And we see three dimensions to this. Firstly, the aspirations and the loyalties of ordinary Afghans need to be engaged in defence of their country against the Taliban. Secondly, the insurgency itself needs to be divided. We want to separate those insurgents motivated by narrow national and local objectives and whose aims could be accommodated within the Afghan political system from those unwilling to break with Al-Qaeda. And thirdly, with the leaders of the Afghan Taliban in Pakistan, the international community needs to engage with Pakistan and Afghanistan's other neighbours to promote enduring stability. Now, the political strategy is not meant to be a separate from a military strategy. Indeed, military and civilian resources are critical contributors to it. Reassuring citizens that the Taliban will not return, of course, requires security, but also governance that responds to their most pressing needs. Dividing the insurgency requires military pressure, but also economic and political opportunities. And regional dynamics are affected both by our military presence, self-evidently, and by diplomatic outreach. A political reconfiguration, however, is the lens through which our military and civilian surge must be seen. So that's a very sort of brief overview of what we mean when we talk about the political strategy. So bearing that in mind, let me turn briefly to the three main themes of the conference: security, governance and development, and the regional dimension. On security, and this breaks down, I'm sorry this keeps breaking down to numbers, but there are two parts to the security aspect that I want to draw your attention to, if I may. Firstly, the conference is going to consider how the respective roles of the international and Afghan security forces will evolve over time, and it's going to discuss how international forces can help mentor, partner, and develop Afghan security, as, of course, they are doing already. And as Afghan forces develop, we expect them gradually to assume, district by district, province by province, as the necessary conditions are met, lead responsibility for security in Afghanistan. And to quote Mark Sedwell again, our ambassador in Afghanistan, he has said, what we will see at the conference is a set of conditions and an indicative timeline for provinces and districts to be transferred, but we would not expect to be naming them. I think that's quite an important statement of intent for the conference and shows quite a high level of ambition. And then the second element is about how the conference is going to address the way it can support Afghan-led efforts to reintegrate Taliban fighters. And I think, again, it's important to stress that this is an Afghan-led process with the international community coming in support. And I've got a document here which is evidence that the British Foreign Secretary gave before he addressed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee last week. And it has an interesting passage on reintegration, so I hope you won't mind if I read it to you. It's not too long. It reads as follows. Alongside military force and community mobilization to apply pressure, reintegration requires incentives. The offer of protection from retaliation by former allies and alternative employment. This demands a structured program that targets the right people and ensures that the support continues over time. In some cases, reintegration may involve relocation and de-radicalization programs. The international community can provide valuable support, for example, through the creation of the Afghan Reintegration Fund, but ultimately this must be a process led by the Afghan government. An immediate priority is therefore to develop a strategic framework with President Karzai for reintegration. This will need to assign clear lead responsibility for reintegration within his government, with a dedicated organization geared to reaching out to insurgents. And it goes on at some length about how reintegration might go forward, but I will spare you all that. I think you get the flavor of the sort of thing that we expect the conference to address. Now, I should mention under the rubric security, although it's not one of my two elements, the issue of force generation. Because although London is not a force generation conference, it will be an opportunity to encourage allies to increase their commitments in critical areas, particularly with respect to the training of the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police. The NATO training mission in Afghanistan still has a shortfall of 1,600 trainers, And despite European Union promises to increase the size of the EUPOL police mission to 400 trainers, the total staffing of that mission is only at the moment 267. So there are gaps that need to be bridged, and it may be that London would provide a venue for some of our colleagues in the international community to make announcements of new effort to help bridge those gaps. Second subject of the London conference, governance and development. This is essentially about tackling corruption and promoting economic growth. Now, we know from the elections last year how the evidence of vote rigging, how damaging that was for confidence in the government of Afghanistan. And there is a unanimous message from the people of Afghanistan and the international community that the Afghan government needs to turn its words on tackling corruption into deeds. Now, I don't know how much weight you put on opinion polls but in Afghanistan, but there was a recent BBC, ABC, ARD poll which came up with the unsurprising finding that some 95% of Afghans see corruption as a problem in their local area. Now, such widespread abuse obviously has deep roots and is not going to be cured overnight. But we believe it is vital that President Karzai follows through his promise to tackle the culture of impunity with serious steps. And the new anti-corruption unit needs real powers both to investigate and to prosecute. And the conference in London will be an opportunity for the international community both to hear from President Karzai on this important subject and to underline the importance we attach to it and the ways in which we may be able to help with capacity building or procedures to produce more transparency that are important in the fight against corruption. David Miliband has given us the one-liner, which you may have heard already: the Taliban need to be outgoverned, not just outgunned. And this whole business, this whole area of governance, is critical to a successful outcome in Afghanistan. And with so many provinces now with these alleged shadow Taliban hierarchies of authority, it's more than ever important that the genuine government of Afghanistan at the provincial and at the district level, as well as at the national level, is seen to be able to outgovern the shadow structures belonging to the Taliban. As for development, the conference is going to look at how the international community can support economic growth in Afghanistan with a focus, as you would expect, on rural development and agriculture, and how we can align our support to the government of Afghanistan's own economic plan. I think we all know the basic facts. 42% of Afghans live on less than a dollar a day, and in some parts of the country there are few credible alternatives to the drugs trade or mercenary activity. Helping the Afghans build schools, provide clean water, electricity and roads is worthwhile, of course, in its own right, but it also will help to draw people away from the insurgency. Of course, it's not just about the quantity of assistance we provide. It's also about how it's spent. And if these services are to outlast the international presence, they need to be administered by the Afghan government. This goes back to this point about the nature or the structure of government across the country. District governments in some parts of the country, district governance is almost non-existent. And half of governors do not even have an office, less than a quarter have electricity. Some receive only $6 a month in expenses. And in such circumstances, the Taliban gain traction with their shadow governors allocated, as Bob said, to all provinces except Kabul, and a substantial district-level network also in place. So we have to support some schemes that are already in place to back up and increase subnational government. So far, these schemes have been patchy and inadequately funded. And this is one of the issues that the conference is going to address so that we have a more coherent strategy for this over the coming months and years. regional frameworks, the last of these three topics of the conference. Bob mentioned the important meetings happening this week in Turkey. In terms of regional relations, by bringing together Afghanistan's neighbours and the key regional powers, the London Conference aims to promote progress towards more systematic and cooperative engagement by and between all of the regional stakeholders, building on a range of existing structures. Obviously, the detail of how this is taken forward in London is going to depend very much on how the talks go this week in Turkey. One of my colleagues in the embassy said this is a bit like the story of the prisoner's dilemma, that if all Afghanistan's neighbours work together, none is going to get a perfect result for their narrowly defined national interest, but they all ought to get an adequate, if not a better than adequate, result. However, if all Afghanistan's neighbours work unilaterally only for the narrow national interest, it's likely that the net outcome for each of them will be worse than it would be if they cooperated. It's a sad fact today that Afghanistan, for most of the countries in the region, is a minus in terms of narcotics, refugee flows, and terrorism and radicalization. A stable, peaceful Afghanistan is in the interests of all countries of the region, and we want to find a way to encourage and support strengthen dialogue between the countries of the region and Afghanistan so that what is clearly a sort of common interest in a stable and peaceful self-sustaining Afghanistan is one that they acknowledge and work together for. So in conclusion, the Afghanistan-London Conference should be seen as a key landmark as the international community further cements its support for the efforts of the Afghan government. We hope this conference is going to be followed by an international conference in Kabul later in the year, and then indeed by a further international conference the following year. These conferences are going to have an important role to play in strengthening Afghan leadership, improving security, and building a better future for the Afghan people. And if I'll just end quoting David Miliband's words, he says, "This is a crucial year for Afghanistan. The tempo of operations will increase. So too the resources. We are not trying to build a colony for ourselves. We are trying to prevent it becoming a crucible once again for attacks against the rest of the world. This is a necessary and achievable goal." Unquote. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dominic. Johan.
Okay. Thank you so much, Bob, and thank you, Dominic, for that excellent introduction, and thank you so much also for organizing this London conference this week, which in our view is an early and very strong international response to the commitment of the new Karzai government has made to the Afghan people. Before I have been asked to talk a little bit about the relationship between reintegration and reconciliation in Afghanistan. But before I do that, I would like to add a few comments just about certain Norwegian positions with regard to the outcome of the London Conference. First of all, Afghanization is key for us. And for this reason, Norway supports the efforts to strengthen the Afghan government's role, both when it comes to security, but also, as Dominic mentioned here, when it comes to development. Norway is already channeling half of our assistance through Afghan budgets, and this is to give the Afghans more responsibility over their own development priorities. We have also welcomed the Afghan government's commitment to take more responsibility over their own security and economic development. And for this reason, we have also shifted our own efforts from our own troops when it comes to assisting in training of Afghan troops. And we have decided to provide assistance to the fund for the police, as well as 110 million kroners over the next 5 years to the ANA Trust Fund. Fighting corruption is also another important issue for us for the London Conference. It's critical for the government's own support among the people and for ensuring that resources reach every corner of the country. It is positive that the government has expressed willingness to deal with corruption. A number of plans have been presented, but now the eyes are on Karzai and his government to deliver on these promises. Coordination is another important priority for us. We hope for stronger mechanisms in this field. We do, however, recognize that all donors have different priorities and traditions when it comes to how aid is implemented and the choice of channels. The UN, however, must be allowed to play its role, or we face the risk of losing an important tool for the international community. As I said, I've been asked to say a few words about reintegration and reconciliation in an Afghan context. As you may know, Norway has been involved in a number of reconciliation efforts between governments and armed groups in the Middle East, Sri Lanka, Colombia, Guatemala, Sudan, just to mention a few places. Few of these political processes can be labeled as unquestionable successes, something Dominic very well known since he served in Sri Lanka. But we believe political reconciliation is an important and necessary tool in efforts to resolve conflict. Political talks may notably reduce the humanitarian cost of a conflict and contribute to the transformation of armed insurgent groups. A political process will normally be part of any end game anyway. President Karzai has been suggesting a political process for a long time. I think it's the first signals came in 2006. And Norway supported publicly the idea of an Afghan-led process in early 2007. I would say international debate on this issue has been on the increase, and I don't know if anyone of you saw the Financial Times this morning, where there was a big article about it on the front page. There have been allegations about Saudi Arabian track that broke down, apparently, because of insufficient will from the Taliban side to take a clear step away from Al-Qaeda. Common wisdom now seems to be that it will be rather difficult and maybe contraproductive to launch a major negotiation initiative with the Taliban at a stage where the movement has gained some momentum. I know Ahmed Rashid and others have recently made an argument to the contrary, that now that the Taliban think it's strong, it will be easier to encourage them to come to the table. This, I guess, is open to debate. We know from several peace processes that the dynamics of any negotiation are closely related to the armed movement's own perception of its position of strength. Over the coming months, that situation may change. We are now seeing increased military pressure as a result of the Allied buildup and also as a result of the expansion of Afghan security forces. In addition, the reintegration program that Dominic presented to us here, offering an alternative future to those laying down their arms, may attract fighters and thus weaken the Taliban. We note that the mechanisms for the reintegration of Taliban fighters will be at the forefront of the London conference. Norway has supported civilian efforts in this direction through the so-called Fund for Disbandment of Illegal Armed Groups, the DIAG. The Afghan government has now presented the outline of a new strategy for reintegration. For us, it is very important that this new strategy is coherent with existing national programs and well coordinated through the United Nations. Experience from other conflicts do, however, seem to indicate that standalone programs for demobilization, disarmament, and reintegration do not always work very well. In many instances, only a political process involving the central leadership in negotiations can create sufficient momentum to ensure lasting results and stability. There are several examples of disarmament or demobilization that have occurred without a negotiated solution to a conflict. I can mention a few examples, like in the case where you have a decisive military victory, like Angola or Rwanda, there was a disarmament and demobilization program. You have other cases like where you have partial demobilization of certain groups that are involved in a major conflict, which was, for instance, the case in Colombia, where the paramilitary groups were disarmed in this way without there being a sort of a political solution to it. Although we must note that with the paramilitary groups in Colombia, there were political deals with the specific groups that were involved in the disarmament process. And we've also seen other situations of violence where DDR-type programs have been implemented, like in Haiti. The vast majority of these disarmament programs that have been undertaken outside a political process would be so-called voluntary weapons collection programs, often with the aim of collecting excess weapons that circulate in society after conflicts from civilians and ex-combatants. Most of these programs offer some types of incentives for people to turn in their weapons. Over time, there has been a move from individual incentives, like cash or food or livelihood support, to collective incentives, that is, development projects that are benefiting the entire community. Cash incentives have been widely criticized due to risk of creating a market for weapons, which in some cases have resulted in an influx of weapons from neighboring areas, which is certainly the case in point, for instance, in Afghanistan. The program that is now prepared for Afghanistan is based on collective incentives and has an ambitious and comprehensive approach. We'll not get to go into all the measures here, but we talk about cash for work, for instance, Dominic referred to some of these issues in his talk. Such a comprehensive reintegration strategy, offering educational and employment opportunities, is more likely to achieve sustainable results. In practice, however, there are considerable obstacles to implementing such programs on the ground. A common problem has been that it has taken too long from weapons having been turned in to the start of the reintegration projects, with beneficiaries not seeing the benefits of having disarmed. We must also be aware that the Taliban, of course, will perceive this program as an attempt to split the movement and will offer strong resistance probably to it. The political will of the parties to disarm is viewed as an essential factor, probably the most essential in determining the success of DDR programs. Thus, undertaking DDR outside of any political process to end hostilities is a strategy that may imply some risks. However, the option of a political process with the Taliban does, however, also present a number of dilemmas and problems. First of all, what would be the goal of such talks? We must be very realistic about what can be achieved. This is certainly not a magical wand for peace, but it should be explored whether talks could contribute to find a solution to certain issues with at least parts of the insurgency. One aim could be to nurture a clearer split between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And who do we talk to in such a process? Is the main arm of the Afghan Taliban a unitary movement with sufficient internal discipline and a leadership that you can deal with in an effective way through talks? There will be the need to test their will and ability to deliver. The interlocutor on the other side must clearly be the Afghan government. I am sure that the gradual transfer of lead security to the Afghan government will make it easier for them to assume such a role, but they will need assistance in many fields. Will there be the need for a facilitator in these talks? Can the UN assume such a role, for instance? Then should there be preconditions? A clear break with the Taliban and acceptance of with the Al-Qaeda and acceptance of the Afghan constitutions are good candidates. But the Taliban would probably consider these important bargaining chips in a negotiation and would be reluctant to give them in from the outset. But for the international community and for Afghans, of course, this is a major issue. Timing, as I already mentioned, talking to a Taliban that is perceived to be gaining strength is not easy. The question is whether the Afghans should prepare already now for such a scenario or not. Political price, that's another important issue. A political negotiation normally ends with inviting the reconciled into national politics through participation in elections. The record of the Taliban while in government is such that most people would think twice before inviting them in again. In public rhetoric, we hear some smooth talking from the Taliban about new attitudes to women tolerance, but is this purely tactical or is there any substance to it? We cannot let Afghanistan's women pay the price of stability. Then we have the regional issues. All of Afghanistan's neighbors feel they have a stake in the question. Many are very negative to the idea of giving even parts of the Taliban a second chance. We would face difficult diplomatic work to get the support for any solution worked out by the Afghans themselves. Last but not least, transitional justice. Afghanistan has already faced great problems in the handling of perpetrators responsible for war crimes of the past. And how do you deal with reconciled Taliban that have been responsible for hideous crimes? Are we faced with a choice between stability and justice here? I mention all these problems to stress that while reintegration without political reconciliation may be difficult to achieve, political negotiations at the strategic level with the Taliban will not be easy either. I do believe, however, that the option should be explored, and we need to support Afghan-led initiatives in this direction. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Johan. Both of you obviously have talked about the reintegration, and that's going to be a pretty hot topic at the conference on Thursday. Mm-hmm. One issue that's outstanding is the question of who in the Taliban and other insurgent factions might be potentially included, who might be excluded from those talks. And sort of a separate question, related question, I should say, is how will the negotiations with the Taliban be transparent enough so that the tendency for conspiracy theories to burn in Afghanistan won't end up undermining those very efforts? Will there be, should there be an overall strategic communications strategy?
Yep, okay. Well, who to be included, who excluded? Very difficult question, of course. There are lists, of course, of the UN. Several of these people are listed, which set certain restrictions, of course. Also, we have the issue of transitional justice that I mentioned that will set its limitations. And also, I guess this has very much to do about the whole aim of the exercise. I mean, what are you trying to achieve? Is the main goal sort of a short split strategy, so to speak, or is there a further aim in a way? So I think, I mean, at least I do not have a very, very clear answer to that question.
Do you think... and maybe Dominic, you could touch on this. Do you think the international community or some parts of it would have some red lines about who should certainly not be included in those talks?
Yeah. Yes, I do. I mean, I think our emphasis at the conference, and of course we wait to hear what President Karzai and others say about reintegration and reconciliation. I mean, our efforts are at the local level at the moment. That's where our focus has been. And it's really about dividing away from the Taliban those people who would otherwise be, you know, rather conservatively minded farmers or the sons of farmers, from continuing to fight for an organization for which that you can take away the purpose for doing this by the sort of offer that you could make people on the ground, whether the offer in terms of better governance for them, a better sense of being able to secure justice for their families and for themselves, and for some sort of means to provide for the economic welfare of themselves and their families, and this is what our effort is about. In terms of red lines, I think any kind of lasting connection with Al-Qaeda must be a red line for us and would be very difficult at this stage. And there may be other ones as well, but that's the one that immediately comes to mind.
Okay. In the process of this, it's clear that the central government does not have the capacity to control, certainly not govern, most of its territory. And it's equally clear that there are some pockets of potential capacity, perhaps actual capacity, at the subnational level. And so any strategy, any development work, any training that will take place will have to involve capacity building at both the national and the subnational level. But there's a risk that that the capacity building at the subnational level might undermine the authority of the central government. Certainly, there are people in the central government who think that. What role can the international community play? What what might happen at the London conference that could show a way forward to come up with an appropriate balance between capacity building at the subnational level and at the central government level?
I just say a little bit about it because in my opening remarks I said quite a lot about the importance of governance as that, you know, a major element in that second theme of governance and development. I think there's no doubt in our minds that, I mean, Afghanistan historically has not been a country that has been strongly governed from the centre. I mean, we all know that the remit of the government in Kabul has not historically sort of stretched all the way across the country. And given the tribal makeup and the complexity of Afghanistan, trying to govern from the centre without balancing local and regional, whether they're provincial or district, institutions and organisation is unlikely to succeed. I think that's just a sort of fact of socio-political life in Afghanistan. And I think the conference will be stressing, I think it'll just take that as a given, that there has to be viable regional and local government. And the conference will be looking at ways to build capacity throughout. And part of the message may be that building capacity throughout the country, far from being a threat to the national government, actually provides the only realistic way for which the government in Kabul can really consider itself to be a national government.
No, I think we agree very much with that position, and I've also, over time, tried to support efforts to strengthen local government through different programs. So we certainly agree with that approach, yes.
I want to open it up to questions. One quick question. You mentioned that all of Afghanistan's neighbors, except for Uzbekistan, will be attending the London conference. This includes Iran as well. They've confirmed.
Yep, Iran's going to be there. I'm not sure that maybe my colleagues in London have heard more about what level they're going to be and what sort of contribution they're going to make. Yes, the Iranians are definitely going to be there. And, you know, they have a legitimate place at the conference, given that they're an important neighbor. And they're affected very much by instability in Afghanistan. So actually, part of the success of regional policy ought to be a policy that embraces Iran in the collective effort to have policies by Afghanistan's neighbors that contribute to stability in Afghanistan. So, yes, they will be there.
Great. As I call you out there, we have a few people carrying microphones. If you could just wait until they arrive and hand you the microphone and then just identify yourself briefly before asking your question. So start with Margaret.
I'm Margaret Taylor. I'm a fellow here at CSIS. First of all, I want to say thank you for sharing your time today and your thoughts. My question relates to a particular aspect of governance, which you alluded to, Mr. Chilcutt, which is police training. Do you expect that the conference will produce a discussion about not only the numbers of police that should be trained and who should be training them, but what type of training they should be receiving? I have heard that a lot of the police are being trained in military tactics, which are probably appropriate in many respects because of the situation that they're in. But do you expect any discussion about, for example, community policing training or, you know, the more civilian model, a traditional model of policing at the conference? Thank you.
I think the honest answer is that we don't quite know. I mean, given that the governance and development part of the conference lasts about something like an hour and a half, and you've got at least two, maybe three speakers kicking it off, how much time that will give other people to make the full range of points they might want to make, it's a bit uncertain at this stage how rich the conversation and how widely it will go is going to be. However, I would say that the point you make about police training and the right sort of police training is, of course, central to this whole business of cracking down on corruption and providing reasonable governance and governance that the ordinary people of Afghanistan can have confidence in order for us to be able to be supporting through the Afghan government, you know, their aspirations and hopes. So you put your finger on a very important point of this picture, but I'm afraid, I mean, it's very hard to anticipate how much detail they will get into it.
No, I don't know if I have much to add to that. I mean, you know all the details of the conference much better than I do. So, but just to emphasize that for us, civilian training, of course, is a very important priority. and including also the training of women for these kind of for security forces. And we have a few programs for that as well.
May I add something, actually?
Yes.
What I should have said also that, of course, the kind of method of mentoring and embedding and this sort of training, I'm sure that will be a feature of the conference, because it's a big feature of the kind of modus operandi of training forces and our security forces in Afghanistan, and it's not without risk to our people. And so I would imagine that this would feature at the conference.
It's also the growth of the army and the police is on a fairly aggressive schedule, and that's a management challenge under the best of circumstances. Is there any way to ensure that during the recruitment phase or during the training phase, given, you know, as you mentioned, the shortage of trainers that we have, is there any way of ensuring that the training takes place in a way so that as they build the capacity, that they use it in a way that's actually constructive for stability?
Well, I guess that depends on the training you give these people. But, I mean, obviously when you recruit, but I'm no expert on this, you have to look at what you recruit. So I don't have anything to add there.
I think, presumably, it's not my area of greatest expertise, but there will have to be some measures by which you hold, which you evaluate the effects of your training, and accountability is going to be part of that. And given what we know about the problems linked to the Afghan National Police Forces and issues like corruption and people's sense of security, I think there will be there will have to be some hard follow-up of our training. We, as you say, the figures for the numbers of people that we wish to train, both in the army and in the police, are very ambitious indeed. And they are of a size that we can't expect the Afghan economy to be able to support going ahead. So if we're going to be essentially funding, we the international community are going to be funding the Afghan armed forces and police forces, then we want to be confident that we're funding people who are doing the job for which they're being paid. So I think this won't be just a question of a sort of training and leaving people to it. It'll be training, it'll be mentoring, it'll be embedding, and it will be evaluating and having in place, you know, systems for accountability.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. My name is Hasib Al-Khozai, and I work for the Voice of America South Asian Division. I want to touch on the civilian casualty and collateral damage. It has been a controversial issue between Afghan President Hamid Karzai and the NATO-led security international force leadership in the country. General Stanley McChrystal has made the avoiding of civilian casualties and collateral damage a very important and crucial portion of its overall strategy. However, it continues to take place. And though measures have been adopted to reduce it dramatically, how would this issue be addressed in the conference first, and the continuation of this problem, how would this impact the overall process of so-called winning the hearts and minds of the Afghan ordinary people? Thank you.
Well, of course, this is a very sensitive and important area. The place for it to be raised is presumably under the session which is dealing with the security of the country, which is the first major theme that the conference will address. How it will be raised, or if it will be raised at all, I mean, one has to wait for the conference to know that in detail. But General McChrystal's edicts about minimizing civilian casualties have been widely publicized and widely understood. As we see this to be successful, you need both the military pressure on the Taliban as well as the political strategy to wean people away from the Taliban. And you can't, I've been trying to stress all the way along that both things go together and in combination can provide you with strategic success at the end of the day. So whenever you're applying military pressure, unfortunately, there's always a risk of collateral damage and, the wrong people being killed or injured.
But I think there is real intent by ISAF in minimizing that. I'm struck, I should say, by the fact the Taliban have made a similar parallel statement about wishing to minimize civilian casualties, which, of course, in the context of the irresponsible way that they leave IEDs planted all over the place, which kill a lot of civilians, and the ruthless way in which they deal with civilian populations, is risible. But perhaps it shows that, you know, this is a point of weakness for them, and they've felt in their propaganda that they've had to address it.
I'd just like to add that, too, that in the UN's report on humanitarian casualties, I think that was released 10 days ago or something, it shows that the new approach of General McChrystal has already given results in the sense that the main culprit now for any humanitarian casualties is very clearly the Taliban. I mean, the numbers have showed a clear move here. But it's still a very important issue, of course, that we need to stress. But I mean, the UN itself has underlined that change is on the way. Thank you.
In the back.
My name is Ayub Khaurin, and we have a daily news show to Afghanistan. We broadcast daily from Washington. The reintegration and reconciliation theme of London conference has really shadowed the rest of the conference agenda. And from our reports from Kabul, it has generated or triggered a huge debate among Afghans as well. It's not very clear that how will it be implemented or the process. A few questions in this regard is if this will be taken on provincial level, will the local security agencies be in touch or doing this locally with the insurgents, or this will be a national agenda involving the central command or the central commanders of from the Taliban side as well. And secondly, will they be paid recruited in military, national police, or Afghan National Army, or would they be responsible for taking care security of their own provinces or districts? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, that, you went into a lot of detail in your question. And, of course,
that's what it has already been going on in
Kabul. Well, in a way, that's a very good thing, because as I was saying in my remarks, and as Johan said in his remarks as well, when it comes to reintegration, what we're really talking about is an Afghan-led process, which the rest of us are supporting in the best way we can to maximize the chances of success. So I think, in a way, the right person to address a lot of these questions to is President Karzai and the Afghan government in the first instance. Of course, though, it doesn't mean to say that we don't have some ideas about how it ought to unfold, and indeed it is to some degree happening already. Where it's happening at the moment is very much, though, at the local level. But this, you know, I stress again, this should be led by Afghans who understand how best to communicate with other Afghans. On the question of money, there is talk of an Afghan reintegration fund, which we will be contributing to. I mean, how those monies are spent in the best way to achieve reintegration, again, I leave that for others to say. I think this will be an important part of the London conference, partly because there's so much interest in it, but partly because there's a platform there for various Afghan ministers and for President Karzai himself to address some of these questions in more detail, about which there's so much interest. So I think this will be a big feature of the conference, and rightly so.
No, I certainly agree. I mean, in my presentation, the only thing I did was to present certain dilemmas and things that, you know, questions that arise around both reintegration issue and also the issue of political reconciliation. And it's certainly not our role to sort of indicate anything when it comes to what level this should be done at or the content of such a process. Thank you.
Okay, here in the front.
Hi. Hi, I'm Kumar from Amnesty International. I have three-part questions. First is a regional framework. Will China be part of it? Is it have it's been invited? Are they coming in high-level delegation? Whether India is part of it? The reason is, as you are aware, there is one concern that Pakistan-India battle is being fought in Afghanistan. So India not being there could create a problem. Second is the one issue that you just discussed about reconciliation. Mm. Even though it should be local-led, I'm sure international community should have a very close eye and guidelines. Otherwise, you know the liabilities there. You know, President Karzai's brother is in Kandahar, and he may be a liability rather than asset for reconciliation. And also whether you will recommend Haqqani group as well as Hikmatyar group to be part of this reconciliation process as opposed to only Mullah Omar's group. My third question, I'm dragging on, is the transnational justice. Is transnational justice issue from 79 onwards, or, you know, the suffering of Afghan people started in 79, whether the abuses happened from 79 to 89, it's going to be happen also be included, or it's only between 89 to 94, or only 94 to 2001. Thanks.
We're going to split these questions up between us, I think. on attendance, I can do that one at the London conference. Yeah. Yes, China and India are very much there, and it's very much our vision and the vision of others that in strengthening the dialogue between Afghanistan and countries in the region, that it should include those two countries. And we're well aware of the rivalries that certain countries in the region have one with another and within Afghanistan. And part of what I was trying to set out as the prisoner's dilemma in my own remarks were that so long as those rivalries are pursued in the traditional manner, if you like, then the net effect for all the countries of the region is going to be lower than if they see common purpose in collaborating towards a commonly shared end. And that is the direction in which we hope the London conference will help the countries of the region see their own interests lying. On the issue of reconciliation, leaving aside, you know, who belongs to which group, at the moment what we're talking about is the sons of farmers out in the fields at that level, and whether they belong to one group or another group is not of the prime consideration for reintegration of what you might call, you know, the ordinary fighters who are fighting for their, you know, whatever the Taliban are able to pay them a day to as mercenaries.
Yes, just to add to your question on reconciliation, whether it should be locally led or whether we should involve the Haqqani network or the Hikmatyar. Obviously, I have no answer to those questions because these are questions that need to be defined by the Afghans themselves, you know, how they want to go about it if they decide to opt for a political process. And I think a bit the same with the issue of transitional justice, you know, how far do you go back in history, etc., very much up to the Afghans to decide themselves, but of course there are also international standards for this, but basically very much is up to the Afghans here, and I don't think we should have an opinion really on at least on the reconciliation, how they want to proceed about it.
The gentleman in the back.
My name is Judd Kessler. I'm a former U.S. aid official and now in the strange world of downtown Washington law firms. Appreciate your remarks. It's very interesting and encouraging to hear all the thought that's going into this. I was struck by some of the comments at the end of Mr. Chilcott's presentation about the cooperation of the countries in the immediate region, and the comment afterwards by Mr. Is it Vibe?
Vibe, yes.
That there's a certain amount of resistance to any degree of reconciliation or reintegration. This isn't surprising because what you are talking about is a sophisticated effort at local representative government and so forth, a subject on which the countries in the immediate region are not necessarily great experts. Could you talk a little bit more about the role of the, particularly the Arab nearby countries in supporting the process?
When it comes to the role of Arab countries, I just mentioned because there have been press reports of an alleged Saudi Arabian channel. But since we only have press reports here to relate to, I am afraid I cannot say very much about that. But
even about the general attitude of the surrounding?
Well, the general attitude, of course, as was mentioned, I mean, all the countries in the region will have a concern and a stake in what kind of solution the Afghans opt for the future, how they achieve stability in their country. But I would rather not go into sort of individual positions of countries here. Thank you.
Sir. Afternoon, gentlemen. John Patton, State Department Office of the Coordinator for Reconstruction and Stabilization. I have a question for Mr. Chilcutt on the one or two senior civilian appointments that you mentioned as a deliverable. Wanted to ask, and I've read the briefing notes on this, but I was wondering if I could get a little more context on what that means. If I understand correctly, these will be civilians attached to NATO, EU, UN, or would there be a counterpart at ISAF or in the Afghan ministries? And what might their responsibilities be in differentiation than the ambassadors there are right now? I know it does mention in the briefing notes improving international civilian coordination. So I was wondering if that discussion was developed enough to where are these on par with the SRAP, Ambassador Holbrooke, those kind of positions, or just how they differentiate with the other ambassadors there currently? Thanks.
Yeah. Well, there are first thing to say, there are three civilian appointments which have to be made, and the London conference would be a good place to make an announcement if they're ready and ripe for announcing at that time. The first one is the European Union Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. The second one is the UN Secretary General's Special Representative, the successor to Johan's compatriot, yeah. Kai Aida. And the third is the new position of NATO Senior Civilian Representative. Now, these are all very senior positions. These are people who will regard themselves, I'm quite sure, as the sort of person who sits on a par with Ambassador Holbrooke and does business with Ambassador Holbrooke, as it were, you know, on an equal playing field, level playing field. I can't obviously say anything about what these announcements might consist of, not least because they're still kind of, you know, as you may know yourself, churning through the system. But they have three very important roles. They're all three slightly different roles. We wait for these appointments as part of putting in the last pieces of the jigsaw, along with the, you know, final appointments of the Afghan government that need to be made, where the London conference is a good moment where this all comes together and we begin to see the way forward over the next 12, 18, 24 months.
I'm going to follow up on that. Isn't there a risk that with three different, presumably strong personalities in three important organizations, of diluting the power of international civilian coordination? How will those difficulties be overcome organizationally?
This would be quite a good question, I think, for a sort of master's thesis in political theory, really. I think we have to see in practice how it works. A lot of these things will depend on the ground by the nature of the personalities involved. Mm. I think if you have people together that can form a good team and can gel well together and have a sort of open, cooperative relationship one with another, then I think you'll find real added value from having powerful people leading the civilian effort for these three major organizations. If, on the other hand, and of course this is not the outcome that we either hope or expect to happen, there were to be some sort of dysfunctionality between the three of them, then I think we would be we could be in difficult territory. But obviously, the aim is that you know they should work very well together in as a seamless group.
Questions? You're in the front, please.
Brent Hall, Department of the Navy. You talked about reconstruction efforts, and I'm just wondering what is being done or planned in terms of medical reconstruction. So hospitals being built, training of doctors and nurses, even conducting disease surveillance. Is this something either of you can speak to, and is this even going to be a topic of discussion at the London conference?
We've both decided that neither of us are experts in medical reconstruction. But, given the central role of health services in any country, in any administration's credibility to provide basic services to its people, and given the importance of maternal health as one of the Millennium Development Goals, it's I think, inconceivable that this wouldn't be an important part of the discussion about reconstruction and indeed economic development. To what extent it's going to surface in the London conference, I have no idea. And it would not be an enormous surprise if it was only mentioned in passing in London. But that wouldn't mean to say that it's not actually central to any plans for development in the country.
Perhaps an equally important issue. You hear a lot about capacity building for the executive branch services, but not very much about building the capacity of parliament in Afghanistan. Would either of you care to comment?
Well, I feel in a way that, parliament is flexing its muscles at the moment in the way it's treated the nominations of members of President Karzai's cabinet. And I was with two or three British MPs only last night, who were saying, for heaven's sake, we don't want this kind of accountability from our parliament on cabinet nominations in the UK, or we should never get anybody appointed to the cabinet. So, I think in some respects, we're seeing signs of real flexing of muscles. When I did some work in Brussels for a while, there was quite a strong feeling in Brussels that, the European Parliament would come of age when it, quote-unquote, killed the king, by which it meant when it brought down the president of the commission and this sort of thing. And I think this is partly a function of the evolution of parliaments. I think that they enjoy these kind of standoffs with the executive from time to time, and I think this is to be expected.
Okay. Well, this has been a very good preview of the London conference. Valuable for me. We're looking forward, I think all of us, to the outcome of the London conference. I want to thank our program coordinator, Justine Fleischner, and our intern, Catherine Hubbard, for pulling this event together this afternoon, and others at CSIS who have helped prepare for it. I'd also like to thank Karen von Hippel, our outgoing and soon-to-be former director of the PCR project. Thanks again to both of you for a fascinating discussion. Thank you all for coming. We have some treats in the back. I hope you all stick around for a reception today. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much.